I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. And one of the courses that I teach, at least every other year when I can psych myself up for it, is a course called Trash Lit by the students. The catalog cleans it up a little bit for consumption by potential students and calls it popular American literature. It's not in fashion, I suppose, in most English departments to pay attention to trash or to popular literature because there's so much quote-unquote good literature to read. And I'd like to begin tonight by telling you why I do it and then to take a segment of what I do and try to explore with you some of the rationales for doing what I do. Trash, I suppose, Horace said there's no accounting for taste, and I get students who say, how can you tell me that Shakespeare's better than Hot Rod Magazine? Who's to judge? It's what I think, it's what you think. And there is some substantiation for that. On the other hand, since the mid-19th century, there has been in America, and I suppose in other cultures too, at least two reading audiences. The minute we got universal education and nearly everybody became able to read, a new literature sprang up, mass literature. It coincided with our ability to reproduce this rapidly and in quantity. And so today, the students that I get coming to Augustana are in one camp or the other. Very seldom, for instance, does a person who reads New Yorker or who reads John Updike or who goes to art films also read the National Enquirer or the magazines at that level. Very seldom does a person who reads the National Enquirer read the New Yorker or go to opera. That split, it seems to me, is increasing widely. What we teach usually in the school systems in great literature probably is greater. It's more sophisticated. It's more complex. It raises issues. It confronts us with more probing questions. On the other hand, that great body of popular literature shows us something, I think, about where we came from, what we felt, and what we have thought. If you want to know what people in the 19th century felt about slavery or about women's liberation or women's rights, the place to go probably is not Hawthorne or Melville, read by very few people. Melville was unable to even get his last works published. And Hawthorne, as successful as a novel like The Scarlet Letter was, and as great a part of the literary canon as that is today, nevertheless, in its first year of publication, sold 3,000 copies. It was vastly outsold, both by Uncle Tom's Cabin, which in a matter of weeks sold 300,000 copies, and by the most popular book of the decade of the 1860s, a book by Susan Wetherell that is the equivalent, I suppose, of contemporary soap opera, The Wide, Wide World, full of weeping girls and tragedies and villains and so forth, leading Hawthorne to write his famous letter about those damn scribbling women who were coming into the scene to begin to write for this mass audience who wanted not to be confronted, not to think, but to be entertained. And that's continued today. One can get into all sorts of arguments as to where television is. Is television going to become a serious medium, or is it always going to be a mass media? But essentially then, what we do in this class is to look at those books which made an impact on the way people thought and felt, and not necessarily ask the most profound or the rightest questions. To read Uncle Tom's Cabin is to get another insight into slavery than you might get from reading a more sophisticated book. The area that I would like to concentrate on to illustrate the power that popular literature has on all of us, whether we are readers of it or not, is the Western and the Western experience. Because it seems to me that that is where we have tampered the most. When we think of ourselves as heroes, it's generally the cowboy where we begin. Certainly, if America has any hero, any folk hero in the eyes of the world, it is the cowboy. I became intrigued, and one of the things that led to this course was what we've done to the West. The West that you see on Gunsmoke, not so much anymore. We're in a lull now, but we're told that within 2 years the Western is going to be back on television and back in movies as popular as it ever was in the 60s and early 70s. It is still true that about a fourth of all fiction published in America is Western fiction in the space age. It's still true that you can go into almost any Kmart and find far more holsters and six-shooters than you can find space toys. And children, if they play at all these kinds of games, are still playing cowboys and Indians far more than they're playing space race or anything, or landing on the moon or anything like that. So the Western, I want to start out by suggesting, has a real hold on our imaginations, far in excess of its actual importance. For instance, the actual West, the Wild West of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp, that Wild West historically was a very, very short period in our history. 17 years, some critics say, from the end of the Civil War, which suddenly sent all kinds of displaced people west, to the coming of the railroad, which brought with it towns and civilizations and law. It was not a very large period, and yet it has become the prototype American experience. Sociologists looking back suggest another fact that we may find shocking, and that is, and it's understandable when you think about it, as many as 70% of the cowboys in that real West were blacks. Why? Because the slaves after the Civil War had no place to go, were forced west, and there were forced to take the lowliest jobs, the jobs that nobody else wanted. Even the cowboys who were white were primarily from the South, from Virginia, from people uprooted and displaced. Look at photographs, for instance, of real cowboys, the few photographs that exist, and you'll see all sorts of black faces. And it isn't until recently, until Italian movies, ironically the spaghetti westerns, that we begin to have black faces back in our westerns. We've created a white West that never really was and never really existed. Some of the Western heroes that we have made into white heroes, in fact, were originally black heroes. Deadeye Dick, the Dusky Demon of Denver, was a famous black cowboy hero. But I grew up seeing him in movies as a white hero. The famous Western duel in which the hero and the villain face each other at sunup or sundown or high noon or some other place and try to outdraw each other in a kind of poker game for high stakes. Historically, we can find about five of those occurring. On the Late Show, almost any night, you can find more than five. So we have taken this small experience and expanded it way out. The famous scene in which the wagon trains are in a circle surrounded by whooping Indians who get closer and closer and closer, and before the whites win, or occasionally the Indians win, that did happen. But never with the frequency that it happened in television. One of the most famous battles, if you've been near the Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota, where one of these famous fights took place, it took place from sunup to sundown, a period of a little more than 12 hours. It resulted, I think, in something like 8 wounded and 3 killed. 2 Indians killed and 1 white. Guns were inaccurate, and the Indians really didn't get close enough for bullets to be accurate. They weren't trying. We now know they weren't trying to do in the wagon train. They were simply showing off their bravery. How close can you get to the white guns and be shot at and bury your breast? So the battle that we have made out of it is absolutely fake and artificial and false. So I'm suggesting then that the myth of the West that we all have grown up with and the hero that we have developed as a result of that myth of the West has, in a sense, not guided us in the way good myth can, but has misled us in the way bad myth can. Myth can mean, can't it, two opposite things. It can mean a way of organizing history. Myth is the story in history. A way of organizing history in such a way that it becomes meaningful for us. Who are we as a people? On the other hand, it's clear that myth can be used to mean falsehood. It's artificial. It's fake. And in the way, I suppose, that myths like men don't cry, or women are the weaker sex, or all these little myths that we live with, and that do us a great deal of damage because we organize our lives around them. So I want to suggest then tonight that the myth of the West, and I'll try to explain how it arose, and the hero that it produced have really been very, very detrimental for us as Americans. That it's a popular myth because it is a trash myth. It's a myth that we have invented rather than discovered. Good myths are discovered by a people. Bad myths are created to control. And the West and the Western are bad myths. I think that's one of the reasons why you would think that with our interest in the Western and our seeing ourselves in that, the great American experience, that out of the Western would have come the great American novel. But of all the literatures that America's produced, the Western has produced the least significant fiction, the least significant movies. Some good ones, some not bad ones, some serious ones. But there is no Iliad or Odyssey in our Western. There is no Macbeth. There is no Faustus in our West. And the reason for that is that it is fake and artificial. Let me begin then by referring to a critic some of you may be familiar with, Leslie Fiedler, whose suggestions I am using quite heavily in this lecture. And talk about what Leslie Fiedler called the invention of America. Fiedler's point is that one of the reasons we have such difficulty as Americans coming to grips with experience and with our, particularly our American experience, is that America was invented before it was discovered. Long before there was an America, there was an idea about what we would find here. And the idea has never quite come up to the real experience, or it has always gone ahead of the real experience. Fiedler traces the problem all the way back to ancient Babylonia to what he calls, and other critics too, call the myth of the West. The myth in Babylonia that followed civilization to Greece, to Rome, to Europe, the myth of the West, the idea that as civilization went upward, it also went westward. And history seemed to confirm, in fact, the myth of the West, because as civilizations rose and fell, those civilizations, becoming greater and greater and greater, went westward, until finally England ruled the world from the very western end of the Atlantic. So Fiedler suggests then that the first colonists, the Puritans, the other settlers who came to America, came with a heavy freight of myth behind them, came expecting to be the biggest and the best, came expecting manifest destiny, came expecting that somehow we were called to be a conquering country. And that gave us very little, the American Indian, as a result, gave us very little problem. It was our destiny to subdue and conquer the American Indian. There was very little question about that by many of the early colonists, not the kind of agony that we're going through now. The other problem is that the ancient world, the West, is further mysterious, not only because of this myth of the West that has sent many explorers, including Columbus, out to discover a way westward, but the mysteriousness of the West was enhanced by the fact that the ancient world thought more in three directions rather than in two. There were three major continents. There were three major races. There were three sons of Noah. There were three wise men representing the three known parts of the world. The Pope's mitre, signifying the temporal sway over the world, has three parts to it, not only indicating the Trinity, but indicating to people like St. Augustine the fact that the world had three parts. And in a very famous argument, which is simply one of many hundreds of arguments along these lines, St. Augustine argued that if one went across the Atlantic Ocean and discovered a land over there, that land would be either a superhuman place inhabited by angels or a subhuman place inhabited by beasts and animals. It could not be, says St. Augustine, a place inhabited by souls for whom Christ died. Otherwise, the Pope's mitre would have had a fourth part indicating that land too. And as a result of that, if there were people there, says St. Augustine, either they're beyond the need for salvation or they're beneath the ability to be saved. And in a sense, in that argument by Augustine, is our problem, says Feeler, with the American Indian. We don't know whether to treat him as a beast to be wiped out, to whose lands we could take, or to be idolized and revered. Should we follow the Indian way and build a path only one lane wide, only one moccasin wide through the forest? And I think we've shifted back and forth. We started out, obviously, thinking of the Indian simply as a savage who could be killed. The Puritans did not, or made very, very little attempt to Christianize the Indians. They were animals to most of the Puritan theologians. Now in the 60s and 70s, the Indian has become revered and emulated. And now it has become a great thing to follow the Indian way. But in the middle of moving from beast to angel, we've forgotten the real human being. So many of our problems, I think, with the Indian then, comes from the fact that we have mythologized, even before we came here, all sorts of strange ideas and myths and stories about the American Indian. Other civilizations, too, saw the West as somehow a different place, not just another piece of land. Either it was Eden, it's where good King Arthur went, it's where Avalon is, where King Arthur lies sleeping amid the apple blossoms awaiting his second coming, for the Celts. For the Greeks, it was the Hesperides, the Fortunate Isles. But somehow always, even before it was discovered, it was mysterious. Robert Frost, if you go back to Kennedy's inauguration and look at the first line of the poem that he read for that inauguration, wrote for that inauguration, that first line really sums the whole thing up. Remember what it was? We were the lands before the land was ours. That somehow here was a country waiting for people who were Americans, even though they were scattered around the world, who now had a home and could come to it. So we came, whether Puritan or Catholic to Baltimore or prisoner to Georgia, we came to America then almost expecting somehow to be new Adams and Eves in a Garden of Eden, or with what Perry Miller calls an errand into the wilderness to subdue and conquer the land and build... Franklin talks about a day will come when there will be no nature left in America. It'll just be the alabaster cities gleam from sea to shining sea, right? And what does it, ask yourself what that means. It means we're conquering the land. What Feeler suggests then is one of the first difficulties we have as Americans and have had as Americans is that we're divided idealists. We have two directions in which we can go. Should we be like Benjamin Franklin and be successful in a business sense and subdue the land, or should we be like Thoreau and participate in it and live at one with nature? It's been difficult for us to simply accept ourselves as just another people and to accept ourselves and the land as just another piece of land. Very difficult to do that. Second difficulty arose from discovery that the world was round. The myth that I'm talking about at that point took on a new dimension, and that dimension was that when the circle would be complete, when civilization had gone westward and met itself again, the chain would be unbroken, a new world, a new golden age for the earth would occur. And because the Pacific Ocean is in between California and the Orient, where vaguely civilization began, overlooking Japan and China and everything in between the Pacific Ocean and Babylonia, the myth took upon itself a new dimension, and that was that we, are, as Americans, were somehow the last link in this westward move. We would be the last great civilization. It was our destiny to close the circle. We were more important than anybody else. we had a great destiny to do. And as a result, we simply raced across the land without paying any attention to the people who were there or to much of anything else. Whitman celebrates that too, the way in which American technology and know-how is bringing the dreams of the old seers into fruition. Now, what about within this context the American hero? How did he get to be the cowboy and the Western? The Western could have, I want to suggest, have become a serious literary form had it not gotten taken over by the mass media and subjected to a long period in which it was cheapened and sensationalized. James Fenimore Cooper, if you remember the Leatherstocking Tales, created Natty Bumppo. And in the creation of Natty Bumppo, a man who lives on the frontier, having come from civilization, but having also picked up what he calls red gifts, a man who is a combination of red gifts and white gifts, Cooper seriously raises the question of the frontier. Should we, is the civilization that's coming, chopping down the trees, bringing the towns with it, is that an evil or is that a good that is spreading across the land? And I don't think Cooper, in spite of the fact that he came from a landed family and whose family founded Cooperstown, New York, was all that sure that civilization was a good thing. He saw it was coming, and I think he saw it was inevitable. But in the character of Natty Bumppo, the first Western hero, he raises all kinds of ambiguous questions. If you leave men to themselves, some men will become noble and mighty and great. Others, like the scum who also follows the route west, will become despicable and bestial. And I think Cooper's suggestion probably is that civilization is probably a necessary evil because it will give up our heroes, but at the same time it will control the savages. But I'm not sure Cooper himself really believes that. He's struggling with it in the novel. And one of the marks, I think, of a good novel is that it does struggle with serious questions. Cooper also asks the question, to whom does the land belong? Is our way right, where I own an acre of land or 100 acres of land, or is the Indian way right, in which we as a people own the land, or does God own the land? How ought ownership, how ought this land to be divided up? Cooper, had writers continued in that train, probably might have created an honest hero, but that didn't happen at all. What happened instead was that the Western got cheapened and sensationalized. Okay, now, how to shorten this so that it makes some sort of sense. Beginning in 1860, giving in to this new audience who wanted popular, rapid entertainment, writers began to take up the Western and the Western hero, and very quickly centered on the cowboy as the prototype hero. And I'll pass around a couple of these. These are the dime novels, if you've heard the phrase. These were done by the thousands, by writers who could write a whole novel in 12 hours, who did it by the hour, working in an office, who churned out tons of this stuff, and therefore didn't have the time or the inclination to really be serious. All they did was take the Western hero, give him the qualities that we see in him today. Let me pass out a couple. Here is the first dime novel, before it begins to be the cowboy, and here's the dime novel, Buffalo Bill, after it's had a chance to kind of solidify and set in. I'd like to use as an example of what the Western and this power of myth can do, the problem of Buffalo Bill. E.E. Cummings has a poem which begins with the first line is, Buffalo Bill's defunct. Okay, why defunct rather than dead?
Like a bank with nothing in it.
Like a bank with nothing in it. Buffalo Bill is, it seems to me, a living example or an defunct example of the power that this legend has. Ned Buntline, one of the most prolific writers of dime novels, who had been writing stories of the sea and stories of everything else in this popular vein, decided to go out west and see if he could mine this new vein of exciting adventures. The West was just being opened up in the 1860s. And Buntline went to Fort McPherson in Nebraska to Major Frank North, whom you've heard of, who led a command of 20 scouts, to see if North would mind being made into a hero of a series of novels. North declined, and if the story is correct, simply pointed to a young 26-year-old scout who was fixing a wagon wheel at the time and said, "Why don't you make a hero out of him?" That turned out to be William F. Cody, who had earned the nickname Buffalo Bill because of the sport he had killing buffalo, partly for the crew and partly for sport. He had distinguished himself in very few other ways at all. He was certainly no hero. But taking the bare facts of his experience as a Pawnee scout, Ned Buntline took the Cody story back and wrote a dime novel called Buffalo Bill, the King of the Bordermen. Overnight, it became a sensation, a rage. Ned Buntline did what anybody would do, started churning out sequels about Buffalo Bill's wild and exciting adventures, and then got the brilliant idea of bringing the real Buffalo Bill to the East to show him off, to put him in a show, and so he did. Buffalo Bill was supposed to arrive with some Indians and some fellow scouts. He had forgotten the Indians, and so they had to hire actors. This was in Chicago in, I think, 1867. I'm not sure of the date. In 4 days, Ned Buntline wrote a script for this Wild West show. He had to stay on the stage to feed Buffalo Bill his lines because Buffalo Bill couldn't remember them. The play consisted of very little more than cowboys and Indians shooting it up until the Indians all fell dead. It was, as you might imagine, an immediate success, an overnight sensation. The act went east and became even more the rage. And finally, Buffalo Bill, being the showman and entrepreneur that he was, decided that he would put together his own Wild West show, which he did. And for many years, throughout the rest of the 19th century, the version, the vision of the West that we were given was not the serious vision raised by Cooper, but it was the cheapened and sensational version of the West given by the dime novel and specifically by Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. It is from Buffalo Bill that we get the idea of the white horse on which the hero rides. It's from Buffalo Bill that we get the idea of shooting down the Indians. It's from Buffalo Bill that we get the idea of the long fringe and so forth. Very little of this was actual or true. It was simply part of the showmanship of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Here's a poster if you want to take a look at Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. Buffalo Bill himself, Buffalo Bill did have a few people in the Wild West show who were good. Annie Oakley, who really was a very good rifle shot, but Buffalo Bill himself wasn't, and so when Buffalo Bill came on with his six-shooter and shot clay pigeons in the amphitheater out of the air, he did that because he had birdshot in his six-shooter rather than pistols. So in a sense, then, Buffalo Bill's whole life was a sham and fake. By the end of his life, Buffalo Bill was quoting to reporters, "I can recollect when I was a young boy on the plains doing this and doing that." The things that he recollected himself having done were straight out of the dime novels that Ned Buntline had written about him. So that he becomes the first example of a media hero, a hero created by the media who is totally different from the real person. And it ruined him. He is one of the only two men in American history who have been awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, only to have it taken away upon subsequent investigation. His funeral, I suppose, is an example of what happens to fake and artificial heroes. He founded Cody, Wyoming. Some of you may have visited the Buffalo Bill Museum in Cody, Wyoming. He founded the Cody, Wyoming, and it was in his will that he be buried in the town that he founded, Cody, Wyoming. Obviously, Cody, Wyoming wanted him buried there because it would sell well. But he had the misfortune of dying in Denver And a group of entrepreneurs decided that he would make a great tourist attraction for Denver.
So they offered his widow $40,000 to bury Buffalo Bill in Denver, Colorado. His widow wired Cody, Wyoming and says, "You have 3 days to match the offer." Cody, Wyoming was unable to match the offer. Buffalo Bill was buried in Denver, Colorado, with huge posters advertising a buck and a half to come to Buffalo Bill's funeral. A bundle was made from the whole thing. And wasn't it in early 1960 sometime that a group of Cody, Wyoming people came down and tried to dig him up and take him back to Cody? Whereupon Denver encased him in about 10 tons of concrete, and Buffalo Bill now is where he's going to be for a long, long time. But his death, that's what Cummings means when he says Buffalo Bill went defunct. What he means by that was not that he's dead, but that he never was alive. He was fake and artificial from the very beginning. Not only Buffalo Bill, I want to suggest, but almost all of American culture has been tainted by this essential fakiness that we find. And that's what seems to me to make the American heroes so different from the kind of heroes you see in Arthur and Odysseus and Odin and all the heroes that other cultures have. Our culture has produced a hero who is essentially, and I'm now getting to why the Lone Ranger never got married, who is essentially a small boy, a child. The American hero, and I'm not certainly the only one who has pointed this out or the first one, the American hero is like a small boy at play. What we have done, if you look at the cowboy hero closely, is to take the old romantic, feudal, chivalric idea of the relationship between men and women and simply turned it topsy-turvy. Not that that one was right and ours is wrong, but it's very interesting to me. One of the intriguing things I find about the American hero is the way in which we have taken the old feudal systems suggested that the woman was the spiritual element, the man the earthy element. The woman was up on her pedestal, probably got it there because of adoration of the Virgin Mary and the lyric poetry that arose from it. But that's the old world system. And it was clear then that in marriage, it was a come down for the woman. She was brought down from her pedestal. Maybe it was a necessity, but nevertheless, she lost something in the transaction. But look at what happens now in the Western. Look at the prototype Western, the Virginian, and all the Westerns that have come from it. Essentially, what we have is the woman being the bearer of civilization, the materialist, the schemer. She's the school teacher always, isn't she, coming on the train from the east. There's the cowboy out having fun, where never is heard a discouraging word, just playing with his gun, loving things. He sees her. Oh, his heart starts to go pitter-pat. Pretty soon, there he is in the sixth grade in the back in a desk that's too small for him, learning to read and write. Pretty soon, they get married. Or, if the alternative is to kiss the horse. But at the end of a cowboy movie, two things have to happen. It can happen both ways, but isn't the prototype, as it is in the Virginian, they get married, and what we see is the guy takes off his guns, he hands them to his sidekick, gets on the buckboard filled with grain, they're going out to plant, they're going out to start a farm or start a town, he's got a suit on, for heaven's sake. The young school teacher, now married, has a knowing smile on her face, and off they ride into the sunset. And what happens to the sixth graders in the front row? They boo. Because I think already in our culture, we men have learned that somehow marriage is a come down. It's a putting away the fun and games, and it's a process of growing up. You don't have to only look at the cowboy as a hero. One of the strange facts of American literature is that it is full of heroes who are essentially kids and who have an adolescent view of women. It's been remarked that there are no strong, great women in American fiction the way we have in Russian fiction or German fiction or English fiction. And with a few exceptions, I think that's true. You might say Hester Prynne and in the Scarlet Letter, and there might be a few others. But essentially, isn't Tom Sawyer the prototype? There's Tom Sawyer the hero. Quite often, a writer will avoid it by putting his hero where there aren't any women to be concerned about, Huck Finn and Ishmael and Moby Dick, and send him off to sea or something. But essentially, Tom Sawyer, I think, sort of has become the kind of little boy hero that that all of us have grown up admiring. Tom Sawyer divides his women adolescently into three categories. There's the sweet young thing, Becky Thatcher. This is true of Little Abner, too, isn't it? There's the sweet young thing, Daisy May. There's the old wrinkled spinster, Widow Watson. There's the good mother, Aunt Polly, and so forth. But nowhere is there a whole woman. Nowhere in that book is there an adult relationship. At the end of Tom Sawyer, Twain makes a little apology for, well, I better quit the book now because the next stage would be to take Tom into adulthood. But somehow Twain is, for all the characters that Twain creates, he's unable to create a real woman, unable to really look at the world of woman as if it were an adult. Look at Blondie and Dagwood. Let me just give you some other examples from popular literature, although this happens all the way through serious literature too, as I try to suggest in Tom Twain, in Mark Twain. Blondie and Dagwood. There is Dagwood, the little kid, fumbling around, getting fired, getting kicked out, unable to resist salesmen. There's Blondie, who makes the thing run. Pappy Yoakum. What is he good for? Nothing. It's Mammy Yoakum who fights the fight, who gets the job done, who is strong and practical and knowledgeable in our culture. Freddie Flintstone, right? There are the Flintstones. The women aren't so great in the Flintstones either, but at least they do keep the house together a little bit better than the men do. Wherever you look then in our culture, and as we grow up with these myths, comics though they might be, TV programs though they might be, look at the way in which the male is always portrayed as what Bernardine Spell, the Episcopal priest, calls perennial adolescence. We're always lost on a desert island, along with Dobie Gillis and other people, and we're essentially kids at heart. And I think that's a rather damaging situation. Why we're this way, I don't know. Leslie Peter's suggestion is that American culture has been arrested at an adolescent stage of development, has never gone on to cope with mature problems or to look at mature problems, and that as a result, women's lib has a long way to go. We can accept it rationally. We can accept that it ought to be that way, but somehow the myths that surround our culture conspire against it. Let me end with an example of how I think this worked its way out. Several years ago, when it was commonplace to give bomb shelter quizzes, I don't know if you know what a bomb shelter quiz is, but they're used in psychology class, but also we use them in freshman English to do a unit on thinking. And the bomb shelter quiz is, an atomic devastation has taken place, you are in a bomb shelter along with eight people, but it can only hold five. It's your bomb shelter. You have to decide which three people go out. And you stick all kinds of people in there to generate some controversy. There's a psychologist and a minister, a pregnant woman, a black, and a sexy blonde, a whole Mac major, and so forth. And then you say, who would you kick out and why? And I gave this to a class of about 73 sections of freshman English, about 70 students. And it didn't really hit home the roles that we imagine ourselves in until I got the results of the bomb shelter quiz back. All of them, as you might expect, kicked the minister out, right? Because he'd feel bad being left behind. he'd want to go anyway, right? Reason number two is the people going out need a minister. And then reason number three I thought was interesting, with a psychologist down here, who needs a minister? So that may give you some idea of the level of thinking at which these students were operating about 8 years ago. But I was intrigued by the pregnant woman I had in there and what was done to her. not a man or a little boy in any of my three freshman sections had the guts to kick the pregnant woman out. She's suffering all the schmaltzy romantic reasons. She's suffering enough the way it is. There's another life there. You know, all what you think of as essentially feminine and romantic reasons were the reasons that came from the men. Not a girl in any of my sections kept her. Things could get messed up. You know, we don't want another mouth to feed down here. And at that point, I started looking around corners to see if there were women students around, because that kind of practical, everyday running of things was exhibited by my women students, the kind of schmaltzy, mooning around the locker, fuzzy, romantic reasons came from the men, suggesting at least to me that that particular freshman class represented clearly the kind of perennial adolescence in which we see ourselves as heroes. The Lone Ranger can't, there's a great line in the Virginian, let me end with that, and that's my explanation as to why Women's Lib is having a harder time than it ought to, or ERA is having a harder time than it probably ought to. A husband and wife are talking in the Virginian about the Virginians falling in love, and about how different this particular husband is from the Virginian, who is young and virile and heroic and so forth. And the wife chides him for something, and his response is, "I guess husbands are a different kind of man." Suggesting that you really cannot be a real man in our culture and be married. That runs all the way through our fiction. It runs not only through popular fiction, but it runs through our serious fiction as well. I don't know where it came from. There are all kinds of wild suggestions. Leslie Fiedler again, in a famous essay called "Come Back to the Raft Again, Huck Honey," suggests that somehow there's a latent strain of homosexuality running all the way throughout our culture. Look at the way, for instance, in which instead of a woman companion, the hero always has a sidekick. The Lone Ranger has Tonto, and generally, he's of a different level socially or racially. The Cisco Kid has, who was it, Poncho? The Ishmael has Queequeg. Huck Finn has Jim. All the way down through, we see the pals. Again, the little boy and his buddies. All the way through our fiction.
You are writing some Maddie names?
Sure. Mad Dillon and Festus, or Chester.
Roy Rogers and Dale Evans.
Right. Okay, now, does anybody want to respond or have any questions?
Well,
yeah.
I think it's interesting to look at the whole Star Wars scenario type stuff, and it's just the very same stuff all over again. That all of the male female roles are the same kind of naive heroism. Luke Skywalker can never grow up, because he'll lose whatever appeal he's got. And
exactly.
And his sidekick is a robot.
Right.
You know? And the Wookiee for Han Solo, who's an animal, is a total thing. But same bit all over.
Or the Dick Van Dyke Show with a bumbling, stumbling husband and a somewhat more practical woman.
One person who, in a way, does the same service to us that you do is Louis L'Amour on 60 Minutes,
yeah.
Which some of you have seen. The question is, do you agree with him a lot? Or have you read any of his stuff?
Yeah, he was just in Rock
Island. He considers himself an active historian, and I've told him where he thinks it's a challenge, at least for 60 Minutes.
Have you heard the Western song, "I've Got No Use for Woman"? One of the suggestions offered, you don't have to get all sorts of, you know, psychological, the way Leslie Peter does, is simply that the real West had so few women that a myth had to develop, sidekicks had to develop as an alternative to this. So that at the time our male image in America was growing, there were too few women to go around, and this is simply the practical result of that. Look at the heroes that Western civilization has produced. Odysseus, Arthur, they were all married. Not often happily, but they they were somehow more complete men than the heroes that American culture has produced. They at least knew what to do. They didn't get embarrassed and shuffle around women. But from Natty Bumppo on down, the minute a woman appears on the scene, the hero blushes and says, "Ah, gee, gosh," and so forth.
Is there another explanation also, and that is that for years, many Americans were moving west to a great extent on a survival basis, and could it be that the Eastern intellectual had time to sit and write his book, somewhat in jealousy over the man moving west, and giving a critique of that, and missing some, as you point out, some very obvious facts. There weren't many women. Also, there were some fairly mean Indians, as I understand it. And I would like to make one, there was at least one person, George Fox, who was not out killing Indians. He was, as I understand, evangelizing or whatever.
That was a Quaker.
And the question I, you're right. The question I have is, what is the myth that we replace that with? What would the proper myth have been?
That's a good question. And a myth is not something, is it, that you can invent any more than you can invent a hero. A hero somehow. I was going to start by trying to distinguish between a hero and a great man. Lincoln, for instance, would be a president who is a hero. But George Washington, as important as he is in our culture, is never seen as heroic. He's a great man. Woodrow Wilson is never going to make it into herohood, but probably he's a great man. Kennedy, however, although if you look at his record, he did very little, and including some important botches, nevertheless, if you look at the school system today, he's in the process of entering into herohood. So in a sense, a culture makes its own myth, and a culture makes its own hero. It can take the most improbable material and make it into a hero. You don't have to have done anything to Buffalo Bill to become a hero. So a great man sort of makes his own reputation. But a hero, now, you can't have a committee, can you? Sit down and say, let's have a more authentic myth in which we can view ourselves as grown up and adult and therefore create for ourselves a richer life. So I don't know how it happens. But it seems to me that some cultures have produced myths that are whole and healthy and that move us on. And there are other myths, like the one I think under which we're operating, that really have cut us off from progress and made it very difficult for us to be authentic persons in our culture. Judy?
Well, it occurs to me that possibly our sports heroes are the same kind of thing. They're just playing. They're out playing for fun. And maybe one of the ones who was elevated more recently, the most, was the one who really botched up relationships with women, and that was Joan Amos. He was really known for that.
But again, aren't they seen as kind of
super
strong, but boys?
Yeah.
Right? It's amazing when somebody turns 40 and he's a sports hero, right? But he's always portrayed. Look at that in the ads. They're all portrayed as the gang. Looking at beer commercials, you know, they're on the locker room with their buddy, not with women. Yeah.
I'd like to challenge your assertion that what you're describing is an essentially American phenomenon.
Okay.
About the same time that the dime novel was being produced in America, we had Bacher in Germany writing The Ring for Nibelungen, which I consider to be a form of German trash, but there isn't a single serious fantasy in it. But isn't the relationship between Wotan and Frey and that one essentially what you've been describing? Where Wotan is running around adventuring and playing, and Frey is trying like mad to keep him home.
Yeah, I guess I'm guilty, let me end with one statement. I'm guilty, as almost every American is, of assuming that Americans are somehow different, even though I knock it and say that's a silly myth. I do it. I used to be foreign student advisor at Augustana, and the foreign students that we would bring a few each year never got over the fact that when they got off the boat, almost the first question an American asked was not what's your country like or what do you do or this, but do you like hot dogs? About us. We wanted the foreign students to tell us what America looked like. We become so America-centered. Yeah, I accept your destruction. Immediately. Sure, I think that's going on all over. And I'm not But I think the small boy, the adolescent attitude that we see, Holden Caulfield, I mean, wherever you turn in American fiction, there's that adolescence that just seems to pervade our culture.
Would you say there's a whole man in any American fiction? Can you think of a character in American fiction that you could call a whole man?
I was going to say almost automatically, because he happens to be one of the few people I think that could qualify as a hero in contemporary literature, one for McMurphy and one for Rupert. But boy, is he a little boy, yeah. So, no, I take that back. No, I can't. In the works that I teach, Ishmael never thinks about women at all. Nor does Tom Sawyer, nor does Huck Finn. The women, Hawthorne's men are all weaklings, absolutely consumed by, you know, they simply cannot stand. His women are strong women.
You know, yeah. I saw that show about Roy Campanella, baseball player.
I didn't know.
And he was talking about baseball, and he said that baseball is a game, you just play it like a man and enjoy it like a boy.
Right, yeah.
Let me ask you one more question, and then I'll give up. The question is, if the myth is as stupid and silly as you describe, the question is, why in the world did it stay so long, and why are we so stupid? Are we really, really that stupid, or was in fact there something to it, although it be distorted? It's easy that you could do the same thing with Hollywood and say it's stupid to watch them, the boys and the girls together. But that is I think that's a straw man. I think there is something to the Hollywood myth. I certainly don't swallow it hook, line, and sinker. But in fact, it has lasted a great deal of time. Women never question it, or very few. Maybe too few men question it.
Maybe they did, and we weren't listening.
Yeah.
You ever learned a new word, and all of a sudden next week you see it five times, and you wonder where it was before? It was there.
There are a lot of women writers, though. And I think I would have to consider them fairly brilliant. I wouldn't accept that explanation. The question is, why didn't the very bright women writers who have written for a long period of time question it at all?
I think they did. I think if you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, you'll discover that Harry Beecher Stowe has absolutely given up on the male population in America as solving the slavery question, and writes to women and says, women, you know, it isn't going to get done unless you get up there and feel. And women have been mothers. They know something about what it means to be separated from family. And the men are just not going to listen. I think that's a novel by a woman, for a woman, about women having the power to do things, because the men are kids and are never going to change.
Yeah.